You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, both Republican and Democratic campaigns are gearing up to bombard voters in Wisconsin and around the country with political ads. We'll talk to an expert about what people should expect from the candidates and how to separate fact from fiction in this election cycle. Now, a recall effort against Governor Tony Evers officially got underway late last week. A Burlington woman filed paperwork on Friday to start circulating a recall petition, kicking off a 60-day window to gather hundreds of thousands of signatures. Democrats were able to force a recall election of Governor Scott Walker in 2012, an election he went on to win. But even getting to that point takes a lot of organization, and so far, an Evers recall isn't being backed by the state Republican Party. Here to talk about it is Sean Johnson. He's WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What have we heard about why this person is starting a recall petition of Governor Tony Evers?
So according to a copy of a state document that Misty Polzinski placed on what was previously a public Facebook page, now private, she talked about unconstitutional mandates and lockdowns that have cost citizens their businesses, home, jobs, and livelihood. And that's a quote from the document that she filled out. She also referred to, when talking about Evers, quote, his tolerance of violence and giving into irrational demands, along with the issuance of premature statements, has not only put the safety of the citizens and their property in danger, but also placed the lives of law enforcement and reliability of the justice system in danger. So she is, we know from other comments that she's made referring to how she viewed the governor's reaction to the Kenosha shooting.
And we're talking with Sean Johnson, who is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief, and we are discussing the recall effort by a citizen.
The unrest
against
that followed.
And Sean, once someone files the paperwork to start a recall petition, I mean, it's signature time. Can you talk about the next part of the process?
So the next part of the process is quite an undertaking. You need 25% of the, I guess you need a number the equaling 25% of the total vote in the last governor's race. So in Wisconsin's case, you look back at the 2018 governor's race, look at the total number of votes, 25% of that means that you've got to be up around 670,000 signatures, 668,327 to be precise about it. And getting that in 60 days is a big deal, especially right now. I know people are moving around more than they were earlier this year, but we are still in a pandemic. People are still being urged to socially distance. And so you've got to go out and get those signatures in person at a time when both parties are really focused on the November general election. And that's where their, person power is being, focused. So there's a lot of things that are going to make it difficult for them to hit that threshold. That's not to say that they can't, but that's just an added layer of difficulty here.
Democrats managed to do all of that, though, although it wasn't a pandemic, in 2012 in that recall effort against Governor Scott Walker. What's different about this push beyond the actual circumstances that we have an infectious disease here?
Yeah. So I would say, number one, and really maybe you don't even need to look farther, is that they had organization behind it. They had the Democratic Party behind the recall, supporting it financially and with staff and volunteers. They had unions backing it in a big way. You had, citizens groups that were funded by unions. So there was just a lot of, a lot of people out there working on this. Also, Scott Walker won his recall, won it pretty handily. But at the time that the recall petition was launched against him, Scott Walker's favorability was not as high as Tony Evers is. Tony Evers has 57% job approval rating in the last Marquette poll. That is, as compared to recent Marquette polls of Wisconsin governors, Evers and Walker, that number is pretty good. So again, these are things that are kind of working against the recall organizers as they start this.
We're talking with Sean Johnson, who's WPR's Capital Bureau Chief, and we're discussing the fact that a Burlington woman has started a petition drive to try to recall Democratic Governor Tony Evers. And now there's this 60-day window to gather nearly 670,000 signatures. You mentioned that Democrats were behind the effort against Scott Walker. What has been the response from Republican leaders about this recall effort?
Essentially that they understand why people would want to recall the governor, but that they are focused on November. I mean, that was basically the statement that was put out by the state Republican Party on Monday morning, kind of paying, I guess, honoring the intent of the recall, but saying that their party's not behind it. And then you've heard other I won't call them party leaders, but I've seen like Jay Weber's conservative talk host in Milwaukee. He can help drive a conservative message if he wants to. And he's chosen to come out against the idea of pushing a recall against Evers right now, just from a tactical perspective. So that's somewhat you've heard from Republicans, is that while this may be happening, they're not necessarily behind it.
And how does it all work with the fact that these signatures will be due shortly before November's presidential election, the general election?
It just we'll add this to the list of complications, I guess. I mean, it means that they would have to basically file it right before the November 3rd election. As you look at the calendar and how it spaces out, I think it'd be around October 28th based on when they've initiated the signature process. So, I mean, you think about what people who make a living in politics are doing in that run up to October 28th. Republicans and Democrats are going to be working like mad on the presidential campaign, for one, because Wisconsin is so important on the national map. And then also at the state level, you have this big race for control of the state legislature, where Republicans are trying to pick up a handful of seats so that they can get a veto-proof majority that would let them, you know, basically overturn vetoes by Governor Evers for his last 2 years in office. And Democrats are working hard to prevent that. So that's where the political professionals are at right now, headed up to that deadline on October 28th.
Sean, you were in Kenosha yesterday afternoon and the evening during President Trump's visit. We see Joe Biden has a visit planned for tomorrow. What did you see, and how should we think about how Kenosha's playing into politics right now?
Well, I mean, it's playing into politics in a big way right now. If you just look at ads that were put out by the Trump campaign and the Biden campaign, they're both referencing the situation in Kenosha in different ways. Trump essentially blaming Biden for chaos, and Biden saying, that Trump is kind of creating this unrest. So they are focused on it. I think the fact that they're both visiting the city this week underscores what role it's playing into Wisconsin's presidential race. We are, a swing state, and Kenosha is kind of a swing county within that swing state. So there are very serious human issues underpinning everything that's happening in Kenosha. And, you know, it's heartbreaking. And at the same time, it is very much front and center in the campaign.
Does anything stick with you from your time in Kenosha this week that you want to share?
Well, I mean, yesterday during the Trump visit, I was not among the pool reporters who were out there watching the president. I was downtown in the square outside the county courthouse, where you've seen a lot of the protests that clashed with police. And I mean, it was just chaos. You had pro-Trump supporters having a rally kind of right next to anti-Trump rally. They were arguing over megaphones. There would be other little arguments that just sprung up all up and down the street, where people would just start yelling at each other. Police are watching it from the rooftop. You had cameras and international press lined up down the street watching all this unfold. So, I mean, it was quite a scene yesterday, although everything that I've seen is that today it is much quieter in Kenosha, and it was much quieter in Kenosha last night as I left the city.
Yeah. Sean, thanks for your perspective on this. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He talked with us about Kenosha and also about a recall effort against Governor Tony Evers after paperwork for a petition was filed on Friday. Coming up, we talk about a corn maze unlike any other with a message based in science and resilience. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. Still ahead, how can you get lost inside a microscopic organism? It's possible if it's the design of a corn maze. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a Wisconsin question about effigy mounds.
At one point in time, thousands of effigy mounds could be found in what is now called Wisconsin. These ancient burial sites are still significant to members of the state's First Nations. We recently received a question through the Wisconsin Project from a listener who wanted to know more about the effigy mounds. Liz Domes went to learn more about the people who created them.
The path winding around Lake Wissota in Chippewa Falls is thick with bugs and sweltering heat. About half a mile into a hike along the lake trail is a simple wooden fence and a sign. Hidden here under thick foliage is a mound that's more than 250 feet long. It was raised with soil 1,000 years ago to form the shape of a panther. It's an effigy mound, one of thousands across the state. Peter Crisco of Waniwok is curious about the sculptors who created these ancient mounds. He's a sculptor too, and nature is his biggest inspiration.
I would like to learn everything that I can about them and, you know, how it's connected to the human civilizations that lived here before and how they connected to spiritual world and how it all comes together. Because I think it's very relevant for our time because we are so disconnected from nature.
Amy Roseborough knows all about the mounds in Wisconsin. She's an archaeologist with the Wisconsin Historical Society.
All right, so what is an effigy mound? An effigy mound is a burial mound made out of earth. It's a sculpture. It's a funerary monument.
That's Roseborough during a PBS Wisconsin University Place lecture in 2016.
Effigy mounds are unlike other mounds in that they're shaped like animals or spirits. It could be birds, could be bears, it could be even human form.
Their creations include the man mound in Baraboo, the double-tailed turtle in Madison, and the panther in Chippewa Falls.
And they're built by a group of people we call Late Woodland between AD 750 and 1200.
In a follow-up phone call with Roseborough, she says the Late Woodland people move dirt with wooden spades and digging sticks.
They are taking the dirt from a very shallow area. In other words, they're kind of scraping dirt so that the land will heal over very, very quickly. And they're not going to make a permanent alteration. They just want the mound to be there. That's it.
In her research, Roseborough found evidence of more than 3,100 effigy mounds in Wisconsin. It's estimated that there were many more than that, but there aren't records of them. Roseborough says about 90% of the effigy mounds once strewn across Wisconsin are now gone.
And once the area started to be settled and developed and colonized by Europeans, they plowed them under, they took them away for fill, they quarried, they built houses on top of them.
State law eventually protected these sites, first in the mid-1980s. Members of the Ho-Chunk Nation are fierce protectors of the mounds. They have long said that they're the descendants of the mound builders, and they've been very deliberate about what they share when it comes to these sacred sites.
The traditional court has told me upteen times that every time we expose this information, it gets sabotaged, ruined, or irreversibly damaged.
That's Samantha Skenendor. She's an attorney at Quarles and Brady and a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation. She spent almost two decades working with First Nations all over the country, helping to preserve cultural sites. She doesn't have authority to share the full story, but Skenendor did say that the mounds are a physical response to prayers of desperation sent by Ho-Chunk ancestors to their creator, Mauna.
They were lacking direction and foundation with themselves, their spirits. Wakan is our spirits. Our Wakan was lacking and needed support.
They prayed to Mauna, who promised to put medicine in the ground.
The Creator built them for us and had them rise up and show us who we are, where we're from, and that those will always be there for us.
The spirit of the effigies will take care of us, but we have to take care of them too.
WPR's Liz Domes brought us that story on effigy mounds. She answered an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, remember a time when you were in a corn maze? Maybe you took the kids, or maybe you were a kid. Did that corn maze have a theme, a design? Angie Trinan of Trinan Farm in Lodi has spent nearly two decades creating corn mazes. 3 years ago, she did a trilobite, you know, one of those extinct marine arthropods, also known as Wisconsin's state fossil. And this year, the UW-Madison graduate with a degree in zoology has another similar theme for her maze. Angie Trinan is on the line with us now to talk about it. Angie, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, we've had you on the Ideas Network several times to talk about your family's farm corn mazes. What is it about the corn maze that keeps capturing people's interest and provides entertainment year after year?
Well, we like to be keep interested and, you know, keep our enthusiasm fresh as well. So every year we go through a process of like, well, what's it going to be this year? What's going to, you know, to either take it up a level, or actually most importantly, it's like, what can we talk to people about that will engage people and, you know, make them curious, and that both myself, my husband, and our staff can talk about in a really enthusiastic way. So that's kind of how we start as far as we're thinking about what the maze is going to be each year. It's, you know, we want to have fun also.
And now that corn has really grown in, we can't keep people in suspense much longer. What design did you choose this year?
Well, so this year the maze is a water bear. And a water bear is a very tiny creature that I had never heard about until about 5 years ago, when I went to a UW Institute for Discovery family, like, science day with my kids. And there were all kinds of booths, all kinds of things that UW students and you know, researchers were showing. I could not get over the fact that I had gone my entire life and never heard of water bears, because they are so adorable, for one thing, that if you look at them, especially under the scanning electron micrograph, I mean, they're about a half a millimeter long. So they're pretty tiny. They're not completely microscopic. I mean, you could see one a little bit with your naked eye, maybe moving a little, but they look just like an adorable bear crossed with kind of a caterpillary kind of eight-legged situation with these tiny little claws. And, but they are so tough. These little guys they can handle really high temperatures. They can handle really low temperatures, like freezing. I've been reading stories about how they can be like dehydrated for 100 years. And then when they're rehydrated, they come back to life. There's actually been water bears experiments. They've been taken out into the vacuum of outer space and then exposed to that for a few days and then brought back to Earth, and they're okay. They're fine. So they are just weirdly adorable, like incredibly tough and just strange. And I, like I said, I'm just fascinated by them. I can't believe I haven't like heard about them or hadn't heard about them. I thought I knew everything there was to know about animals, and I was completely wrong.
You know, okay, I get what you're saying with the cuteness factor, because they have multiple legs and they look kind of, even though they're really tiny, they look maybe a little bit chubby, is how we could call it.
Yeah, they
but
do.
They have this almost raspy. And when you look at your corn maze from the sky, you manage to get that kind of clock turn style thing on the front of its face.
Yeah, it's so weird. I'm honestly not sure what that little thing on their face is for, but it's so cute. They're just very funny looking.
It's just such a strange little mouth that it's got there. It's usually, you know, this teeny tiny creature. It covers 15 acres. Is that right?
That's right. That is correct. That's just short of 15 football fields of corn. And there's 5 to 6 miles of trails that are in there. They're creating the water bear, and then like designs all around it. So, yeah, it's a pretty big water bear, a lot bigger than a real water bear. That's for sure.
Just a bit, just by a bit. When you, you know, now we get to experience the corn maze in all its glory as the corn is taller than we are in a lot of places. When did you have to make the final decision and put everything in the ground?
Yeah, so generally on the day my husband plants the corn maze, which is usually at the very end of May or the very beginning of June, that's literally the day I'm like, okay, I got to get this design done. I have to decide what it's going to be. I just need that pressure. So about 10 days after he plants it, he wants the design. And so then I have to go through the process of like, what's it going to be? And then I have to have a finished design product for him, basically the printed out design, so that he and the crew can go in and cut it into the field, starting when the corn is just a few inches tall. So that's a pretty kind of tight window. So usually they cut the maize into the field about the third week in June is what it typically comes out to, because they have to get it cut in while they can still see the rows. And so it has to be less than a foot tall. So that's kind of a condensed process there in the beginning, middle of June.
What do you want us to think about if we're having fun in this corn maze or another one? What do you want us to take away from the idea that the tardigrade, the water bear, is really highlighted here?
Well, I picked a water bear because like many people, I was really stressed and, you know, nervous and kind of anxious, especially in May when I was designing the maze. And I was like, what is the message that we need? You know, what's something that it brings people together that we can all, a message we can all get behind? To me, the water bear represents resilience. The water bear doesn't necessarily like to be in really tough environments, but it survives in them. And I just, you know, 2020, it's kind of tough. It's kind of a tough year. And I have officially decreed that the water bear is the mascot of 2020. And we'll think about the little tardigrade, the little adorable creature that can handle almost anything that nature's going to throw at it. And
you heard it here first from Angie. Angie, thanks so much for your time.
Right. Thanks a lot.
Angie Trinan and her husband own Trinan Farm in Lodi, and we've been talking about corn mazes. Coming up, we're talking about political ads and how they're part of the election process, but we need to see through some of the different different messages that are being thrown at us now. And a quick note, there have been some changes to the Ideas Network schedule. Find those online by visiting WPR.org/fall2020. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. here on the Ideas Network, it's the morning show. Tomorrow, Frank Nitti Sensenbaugh joins the program. He's an activist and community leader at the forefront of the Black Lives Matter protests in Milwaukee. He recently marched from Wisconsin to Washington, D.C. Tune in tomorrow morning to hear from him here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. It's an election year, which means anytime you turn on your television or watch a video on the internet, you're likely going to hear a campaign ad.
You cast your vote for Kennedy and the change that's overdue. So it's up to you, it's up to you, it's strictly up to you.
It's morning again in America. And under the leadership of President Reagan, our country is prouder and stronger and better. Why would we ever want to return to where we were less than 4 short years ago?
Most Americans believe we're heading in the wrong direction. Higher deficits, chronic unemployment, a president who admits he can't work with Congress.
You can't change Washington from the inside.
But he says he's only had 4 years. That's all Mitt Romney needed. He turned Massachusetts.
That was just a quick sampling of campaign ads from JFK, Ronald Reagan, and Mitt Romney over the last 50-odd years. The tone has changed, but the message roughly the same in these ads. I'm the best choice for you and your family. Remember to vote for me on Election Day. This year, the tenor is different. With the COVID-19 pandemic derailing much of the campaign plans for incumbent Republican President Donald Trump and Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden, the candidates have had to go tough in their ads to cut through the noise, and campaigns have had to compete with PACs and outside groups who are also in that ad game. Our next guest joins us to talk about how we should approach campaign ads during this year's election and separate fact from fiction from both the Democrats and the Republicans. Erica Franklin Fowler is professor of government at Wesleyan University, where she directs the Wesleyan Media Project. Erica, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
take a quick temperature check looking at the ads that have made the rounds this year from Trump and Biden so far. What kind of ad war are we in for until Election Day?
Mostly very negative one, as you sort of alluded earlier, which is not unusual. I think presidential campaigns, especially the last few cycles, have been very competitive, even if it's the polls are maybe, you know, a little wider in certain cases. You know, candidates go negative in part to grab people's attention and to try to win over votes.
Has that changed over the years, or has that kind of always been the mindset?
It is pretty consistently it's a very common tactic, especially in the presidential race. We tend to have a very competitive campaign. What's unusual about it, I will say this year, is that you have the incumbent being unusually negative. And typically when incumbents don't like to stay more positive when they can. But when you're behind and you're worried about closing gaps, the conventional wisdom says that going negative is a good strategy to narrow polling.
What do we know about whether ads affect people, whether they make a difference in campaigns?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think part of the answer always needs to be, what do we mean by effect? Because there's lots of different ways in which advertising can be influential. So usually what people mean when they say, is an ad effective, is usually, does it change people's minds? And I will just simply say that we do have reason to think that advertising matters, but it matters at the margin. And what I mean by that is that, especially in a highly contested presidential campaign, you typically have strong, especially now in a very polarized society, partisan cues that will, you know, there are not a lot of people out there who are actually left to make up their mind. But certainly we do tend to think that the overall volume and balance of the information on the air is likely to correlate with the direction of the polls. So, for example, if one candidate is up on air and the other candidate is not, we would expect to see movement toward the candidate that is advertising. And so that is the reason why you have this sort of ratcheting up of both sides attempting to get their message out to you. And the reason why, you know, two balanced information flows often tend to cancel each other out, if that makes sense.
So let's actually dive into a couple of examples of the ads. We can take a listen now to part of a Trump ad.
Lawless criminals terrorize Kenosha. Joe Biden takes a knee. Biden and the radical left's weak response has led to chaos and violence, and their calls for defunding police would make it worse. President Trump is making it stop, sending National Guard and federal law enforcement to protect Wisconsin's families.
Now, that's part of an ad that the Trump campaign is airing in Wisconsin. He's hitting Biden on public safety with Kenosha. How effective is this ad?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I will say that I think certainly the Trump campaign is hoping that it will be very effective. I think it depends on who you are. I think that the, for Democrats, I think this ad is unlikely to be very effective. It probably is effective in some ways in increasing and priming considerations about public safety among those who are predisposed to be concerned about that issue. So what I mean is, you know, Republicans. And then, you know, it really does depend on so ads can help. And I said before, you know, what we typically mean by an ad effect is, you know, does it affect your choice for a candidate? But ads can also prime citizens to be thinking about particular issues over others. And so I think part of the hope of the Trump campaign by focusing on public safety is to take your mind off of the other considerations that are also top of mind among citizens, which would be about the pandemic. And so to the extent that they can change the topic, that may play into Trump's favor.
I'll ask this question about both. Right now, what should people keep in mind when they hear ads from the Trump campaign?
I think in all cases, when it comes to advertising, you always want to keep in mind that the advertiser is trying to present to you their best case, which doesn't always mean that they're giving you the most accurate information. And I think from a citizen learning perspective, that's not, you know, political scientists tend to have a more optimistic view of political advertising than average citizens, in the sense that we do think that it's not always the case that citizens are glued to the TV and looking at politics all the time. And so the extent to which political advertising can reach them and cause them to pay more attention to a race because it makes them a little more concerned about what's going on, that's not necessarily a bad thing. But I do think it's important as a citizen to keep in mind that, you know, not everything you're hearing is necessarily true.
We're talking with Erica Franklin Fowler, who's a professor of government at Wesleyan University, where she directs the Wesleyan Media Project. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about campaign ads and how the candidates use them, or maybe how outside political groups run ads? Now is the time for your call at 800-642-1234, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Erica, now let's take a listen to an example of a campaign ad from the Biden campaign. This features a woman from Wisconsin.
She was the most welcoming person you could ever imagine. Her home was the safe place. It was difficult to comprehend how quickly everything kind of spiraled downwards. We didn't even know that she had COVID till a week later in her passing. The president made a huge mistake in downplaying this virus. There was a lack of leadership, a lack of responsibility.
Biden is unsurprisingly hitting the president on his administration's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. How do you hear that resonating with voters?
I think it will resonate. I think citizens are concerned about COVID, and I think they're especially concerned when they hear about citizens. And it's no accident that this ad is using a Wisconsin resident in particular to help highlight to Wisconsinites that, you know, this is a at-home issue. So thinking about it from that perspective, I do think that it is likely to resonate with a large number of people. Having said that, of course, if you are a strong Republican, it really doesn't matter what Joe Biden has to say. It's not going to resonate with you. So again, we're talking about, you know, a small slice of individuals who haven't already made up their mind that these campaigns are attempting to compete for.
And again, what should people keep in mind when we're hearing ads from the Biden campaign?
Yeah, I think similarly, you know, keep in mind who is feeding you the information. A politician is naturally going to give you their best foot forward. And that's not actually bad. I think that is good. Politicians need to draw attention to policy issues and the things that they are good at. But it's also, I think, helpful to just keep in mind that, you know, getting some balance of information and fact-checking yourself some of the claims that you're hearing on air.
And there are the facts that these ads put forward, but there's also this music that they put with it. And like, it's meant to stir up emotions, not just provide people facts, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think ads are designed to grab attention. That's one of their key purposes. Citizens, as I said, you know, in a polarized era, citizens, when there is a lot of concern, people do pay a little bit more attention. But it's still the case that, you know, for political junkies like you and I, we will pay more attention than, say, an average citizen. And so political ads are very much designed, especially those that are on television, are trying to reach those audiences that may not actively be seeking out information. And part of the, you know, emotional play is to help scare you into going to get additional information.
We're talking to Erica Franklin Fowler right now. She's professor of government at Wesleyan University, and we're going over the role that campaign ads play in the political process and how we can separate fact from fiction this election cycle. Room for your call at 800-642-1234. We continue this conversation here on Central Time. Thanks for joining us on Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. We are talking about campaign ads, the role they play, and what voters should watch for in advertising this election season. Our guest is Erica Franklin Fowler. She's a professor of government at Wesleyan University, also directs the Wesleyan Media Project, which looks at the role of campaign ads in the political process. And we've got Mike from Madison ready to join the conversation. Mike, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you. Hello, Professor. I think the decision
Citizens United. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Has created the situation that we're in now, where any country can dump billions of dollars into our political campaigns. Any individual around the globe can do so. And it has so severely muddied the truth with tens of thousands of false stories that, a person cannot possibly wade through and dig out the truth, nor could a campaign fend off thousands of stories. And that we are basically living in a time now where I tell my kids the most difficult future you have going forward is going to be determining what is truth, the ability to digitize somebody's voice and make them basically seemingly say anything, and almost to the point maybe where even the video documentation we can't trust.
Huh. Mike, thank you for sharing that perspective here. And Mike brings up Citizens United. What role does outside money play in these campaigns, Erica?
Yeah, thanks for the question. It plays a big role. I mean, we do see outside groups being very active. They're especially active, of course, in the competitive races, because that's where they're hoping to make a difference. And dark money, which is the way in which we, dark money being the phrase that we can't always track where the money is coming from on a particular ad, plays a large role in campaigns. And so not being able to track the source of the information is of concern. I would also add to it, though, that I think just outside groups generally and the increasing nature of them, the way that they, the groups that are advertising on air have names that I will call mom and apple pie. So Americans for an American America, you know, lots of these organizations put up names that sound wonderful and aren't very descriptive about who exactly is behind the ads. And I think that is a concern because we can demonstrate that those ads can be more effective than candidate or party advertising. I can elaborate on that if you want, but that's I can also stop there.
How interesting. Well, we've got Steve from Menominee who also has a question for us. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yep.
Obviously, I guess my question is, obviously these ads are geared towards swaying the decisions of voters and things of that nature. I was wondering if the left and the right have taken into consideration what message are we sending our kids as far as the competition goes and how to go about competition? And it does I was wondering if the host could touch on if she believes it's negatively impacting the youth in our country.
Yeah, Steve, thanks for that question about social responsibility here in political advertising. Erica.
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm not aware of work that looks specifically at the role of youth, because we're typically talking about the voters who actually can make it to the polls. But I would suggest that as much as we don't love negativity in ads, I also don't think we want a world in which we have all positive advertising, because we'd end up with campaign ads that show their families and puppies. And I think as much as I love puppies, I would also like to know what citizens stand for. And we do know that negative ads do tend to have more policy-based information. So there are some benefits to political advertising as it goes. But I hear your point very well about the personal nature of some of the ads that are on air in particular. And I do think that piece in particular, when we have negativity that corresponds with personal attacks, which people think about as mudslinging, that is a concern, I think.
What piece of crucial advice can you offer our listeners as we are watching these campaign ads, as we're confronted with them all election season?
Yeah, so I think the key things that I would say are, you know, pay attention to who's funding the ads. I think that is a central piece. And especially if you don't recognize a group, keep in mind that you may not, this message may be coming to you from organizations, certainly is from organizations that have different motives. So keeping that in mind, looking up more information about the group can be a useful strategy. And I do think, you know, the extent to which an ad might pique your interest, that's not bad from a democratic, small d democracy perspective. But certainly also keeping in mind that, you know, advertising is not the same as information that we would get from news media is also important.
We will watch with a critical eye. Erica, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Erica Franklin Fowler is professor of government at Wesleyan University, where she directs the Wesleyan Media Project. She joined us today to talk about the role campaign ads play in elections and how voters can separate fact from fiction during this year's contentious campaign cycle. Tens of thousands of students are starting classes today at most University of Wisconsin system campuses. Administrators have spent months and millions of dollars on plans to keep students and employees as safe as possible. As Rich Kramer reports, among students, there's a sense in-person classes won't last long.
On a sunny Saturday outside of a University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire residence hall, Mackenzie Miner and her dad, Tom, are unloading clothes, decorations, and her record player into a blue plastic cart destined for her new dorm room.
I think what we'll do is take everything out of the truck first.
Okay.
Mackenzie is eager to start classes, but says she does have some concerns about outbreaks pushing them online.
I don't know. I think we'll be fine. Hopefully. It's just going to be like weird as like an education major, especially in music, but you roll with the punches.
UW-Eau Claire expects nearly 4,000 students in its dorms this fall. The plan is to test all of them twice a month for COVID-19. This week, the campus received last-minute shipments and now has a total of 3,600 tests for residents.
The big day is almost here.
That's Interim UW System President Tommy Thompson. In a recorded video message, he welcomed students back to the state's 26 universities and branch campuses and asked for their help in preventing outbreaks.
What you do off campus is as important as what you do on it, because we want you here the whole year.
Off-campus parties and crowded bars have been blamed for tens of thousands of infected college students across the U.S. and a growing number of universities moving classes online. Thompson sent a letter with the Wisconsin Tavern League asking bar owners to keep numbers down. But recent weekends on Eau Claire's Water Street offered little evidence college bars and dance clubs are concerned about keeping numbers down. UW-Eau Claire senior Morgan Lorenz wore a pink face mask, though other members of her group did not, as they walked from one bar to the next. She says if students follow rules in a required pledge indicating they will wear masks and avoid large gatherings, in-person classes should continue through the semester.
I'm a little worried, but they did do the pledge. Hopefully people actually listen to the pledge.
Last weekend, after Thompson sent his letter, there was more activity on Water Street and a large house party nearby. Anna Song is an associate professor of health psychology at the University of California, Merced. She says college students' brains are still developing, particularly the parts that weigh complex cost-benefit analysis.
So in that age group, what they're really motivated by is, you know, social connections. So we're really asking them to act in a way that is not necessarily what they're wired to be doing.
And the UW system testing plan to control outbreaks is already facing hurdles. The UW system is hoping to test its way through the semester in order to quash outbreaks as the pandemic rolls on. A press release in early August announced 317,000 tests were being purchased for UW residence halls, but the federal government tried to redirect those supplies for use in nursing homes. As of yesterday, before the start of classes, 44,000 tests had arrived. Similar challenges are popping up across the country.
The whole system is really not functioning in a coordinated way.
That's National College Health Association COVID-19 Task Force member Craig Roberts.
This is the whole issue behind whether schools should even attempt to do widespread testing if they don't have the resources to put all the stuff in place.
UW-Whitewater professor and faculty senate chair Tracy Hawkins says she's excited to start teaching again, but despite efforts by administrators to make campus as safe as possible, employees are still uneasy.
So I think people are still feeling a little, you know, like they don't have a clear picture of what's about to happen and how things are going to go.
Back at UW-Eau Claire, sophomore Wyatt Cameron recently got out of 3 nights of isolation after getting a sore throat. He says he had to move out of his dorm room while his test was being processed.
I don't foresee us going very long until we have to go to online.
There's at least one quarantine pool circulating in a UW-Eau Claire social media group. So far, most of the votes predict classes will go online and campus will shut down on a Friday within a month. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to the Ideas Network. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the national political conventions looked much different this year because of the coronavirus outbreak. But should we keep the changes even after COVID-19 is less of a threat? hear what a political scientist thinks about the switch. We're also talking about influenza. We're learning why health providers are encouraging people to get flu shots early and the challenges of dealing with flu symptoms amid COVID-19. Those conversations and more with you on Central Time tomorrow. That's starting at 3 o'clock. And if you're up bright and early, the morning show is having a discussion about the state's archery and crossbow seasons kicking off in just more than a week, learning about the process and safety courses there, too. I'm Keeley Boltina. Thanks for being with us here on Central Time.